you could take like 2 or 3 minutes, like to ask you like 2 or 3 sentences to kind of describe your special collection of archives, collections, one specific collection that you have, et cetera. Not necessarily what you would say to your colleague, but what you might write, say, for your website. If somebody wants to grab a pencil and paper or their phone or something and just brainstorm really quickly, we'll give you about 3 minutes to do that. For those of you who are just coming in, we're doing a bit of audience participation to start, so if you want to keep track on the screen. What you could do is then think about perhaps you could look at this word cloud that we have on the screen here. And if your description included any perhaps of the words that are on the screen, you could raise your hand. So it looks like probably maybe close to 75% of the people in the audience. So if you're wondering about how we got the words in the word cloud, we took text from about 10 different special collection websites and checked out proper nouns and articles and got a total of about 291 unique words, which is put into a visualization prompt. This, of course, is not an exhaustive outline of the language that we use when we discuss our collections, but I think it's a useful way of illustrating how we as a profession can describe our collections and our holdings and perhaps what we do. Following on that, as a way to sort of prep you and get you thinking about some of the ideas that we're going to say today, I'm going to introduce the presenters. I'm Sarah Horowitz. I'm the head of special collections at Haverford College. I'll also put the Twitter handles for all of the presenters up here, so if you want to complete the session, I'll here. Our first presenter, Elizabeth Kaplan, is the AUL, the Assistant University Librarian for Special Collections at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Robert M. Kenneth is the Outreach and Public Services Librarian for Special Collections at the University of California at Riverside. Liz Call is the Public Services Librarian at Burke Library at Columbia University. And Lee Richardson is the Public Services Research and Instruction Librarian at George Washington. So what we want to do today as part of this panel is to talk about outreach, collaboration, and special collections. We've had a lot of conversations on this topic for probably almost a year now, so we're really excited to be talking about it with all of you today. But we really want to challenge the notion of us as a sort of special or the crown jewel within our institution.
broadly, we want to talk about the need to set strategic ideas about outreach and what sort of not doing all this critique is reinforcing in our library. So we advocate for focus on people and not on questions, and we hope that in the end, all the seminars will go home with some ideas, particularly in this case, about how to do more collaboration and advance cultural change in your own institution. So without further ado, I'm going to hand this over to Mr. Kessel. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you to all of the panelists. Thank you for inviting me to join your band. Thank you to all of you for coming after lunch. I think this is a really important and timely discussion, and it's my hope that we will indeed come out of this session with a list of implementable ideas that we can all go home and put into practice no matter what our role is. So, one afternoon this past fall, I joined a group of librarians to watch a webinar to promote this recent publication, Collaborating for Impact. The introduction to the webinar and to the book was provided by Ann Penny, former university librarian at Cornell, who began her brilliant career as an archivist. I was struck by one line in particular in her introduction, and that's this quote, you're right, I think the last great divide is that between special collections and services and general collections and services. These walls, both physical and psychological, still remain more commonplace than not. So, because I function as a head of special collections but have organization-wide responsibilities, this really hit home with me. And if this really is the last great divide in the research library, then I think it is a pretty serious call to action. More on that in a moment, and much more on that from our panel. But first, I think it's worthy of some reflection. There is truly a long and complicated history underlying this sense of a deep chasm between special collections and general collections. And while I can hazard some guesses as to why that is, I do feel sure of one thing. The crown jewel narrative may not have caused this division, but it sure hasn't helped the situation. So let's look at that for a moment. I'm going to share some quotes from taking sort of randomly from various library sources given the past 25 or so years. 1992, at a celebration of ARL's 60-year anniversary, David Stand, as we move inexorably toward greater electronic access to more and more of the standard secondary literature, the computer will represent the great leveler among libraries, but it will be the massive undigested collections of primary sources that will distinguish research libraries. 2001. For most research libraries, special collections are a point of considerable pride. Indeed, these collections are what distinguish and differentiate research libraries. 2007. When once special collections were regarded as the top dressing on the solid cake of main library management, and so I'm sure what that means, they are now regarded as distinctive signifiers on the trademark. ARL libraries want to be known for their distinctive collections, not by some characteristic shared by every other library. And on a personal note, in 2014, I entered a job ad that ended like this. The person in this position will have the opportunity to do all kinds of things to grow the importance of special collections and services that give the 21st century research library its identity. So these are just a few examples. And this is sort of, it feels like a newish thing for those of us who have been around the profession it's the library school. So I think that's important because we have to sort of appreciate the extent to which this notion of the distinctive signifier, the trademark, the point of pride, has penetrated the language and the culture of research libraries. And in extent to which special collections librarians and administrators have been inculcated with it. And that with the best of intentions, an opportunity to elevate and generate support for special collections programs. But think about this. If the message is ingrained in the minds of special collections librarians and library leaders and development officers, it's also been internalized by reference librarians and instruction librarians and liaisons and collecting development librarians and catalogers and excellent services managers and everyone else who makes that solid cake of the library run and serve our constituents. So I confess that the notion of the special collections as giving the library its distinct identity has always made me queasy. For one thing, I think it's a really flawed assumption. I think there are a bunch of things wrong with that in the concept, and I would love to talk with you further at some point about that if you're interested. But as well, I also feel that the distinctive features that elevate you now will inevitably come to marginalize you in the future. When I share these quotes and statements, not because I'm trying to be snarky or laying bone at the feet of the great professional organizations that we depend on and that have supported us for decades, I share them because what it says to me is if you repeat something over and over again, you will begin to believe it, and the people around you will begin to believe it and live it. And what that means is that it is incumbent on all of us to fix this in whatever ways we can. So, starting now, let's disavow the notion of the crown jewel. Let's change our language. Starting now, let's stop shoring up our value and our professional identity by emphasizing differences between us and the rest of the libraries. Let's stop the internal promoting and advocating and start listening and collaborating. We are living in a time where there are so many exciting opportunities available to special collections and archives if we work with others who have the expertise that we don't. A perfect example of this is the Collections of Data Initiative. So these opportunities, I think, will afford us the opportunity to redefine for the good traditional understandings of the value of collections and the nature of audiences and the meaning of research. So let's leave this session in this conference with a list of practical things, again, that each of us can take back to our institutions and implement, no matter what our role is. It's going to take a sustained effort made up of individual acts in order to add up to meaningful change. And this is what I think is the radical piece to it, the idea that if this rubs you the wrong way, if it makes you uncomfortable, if you see there's a flaw here, you can do something about it. And you are about to hear from these three panelists some of those strategies. Thank you.
Presented at conferences where we show up and
Well, sometimes in some cases, we consider content creation, like exhibits or social media, to be under the umbrella of outreach. And our core services and public services, instruction and reference, can sort of sometimes be part of an outreach or they lump them together. So why are we doing any of this? Is the goal of promoting or publicizing our collections or our services or our expertise or the fact that we exist to get more people in? Is it to get more users? Is it to get more record collections? Is it to have better or more meaningful use of our collections, retention, integration of them into anything in business, your teaching, whatever it is your organization is taking this up? I think a lot of times we do content for fun, maybe to get some recognition or to add to a scholarly or public conversation, and maybe it's more reach specific audiences. All too often, I think donors and researchers. And our core services, I think we innately believe that they're valuable. But is that because we know that what we're doing works and is valuable, or because with outreach is that we could spend all of our time and effort and resources on fruitless outreach efforts. Examples of outreach gone wrong, and these are things I've been a part of in the recent past. Having 15 librarians and 4 graduate students at a grad student orientation, maybe not the best use of staff time. If you don't actually know who your brochure, postcards, exhibit, video that you spent countless hours producing before, or who it's meant to reach, you might need to rethink your outreach. And if you're kind of consistently going with the thing, but you're not really sure where that idea really originated, you might want to have a conversation about what your outreach is really trying to do or to accomplish. Universal limitations that all of us face in our own lives are that we don't have enough time or money. And we cannot be everything and everything to everyone and do everything for everyone. That's the fact that every institution, every collection, every repository. So given that, what I think we might want to look for is more strategic outreach plans. So there's a lot of this happening in the business and tech world. Product management is a very well-established and codified So when we get to our animal salary panels or sessions, we are often thinking about the open house, the emails, the looking at the course catalog, the actual strategies that are used. But if we can identify audiences and outcomes, we may have multiple strategies tied back to that end goal. So probably an average plan should have multiple strategies in mind. So if we have a well-defined outcome, let's say 1 minute to check in and see how it's going. And ultimately, evaluation would be to figure out whether or not we've been successful by those outcomes. What else did we learn? I'll take my last minute to make, again, another parallel in instruction that has happened. I was going to say, opening preliminary inspiring, but especially the life and tale of lives emphasis on the importance of a story to show and not tell. An uncurated, curated story, allowing the listener to draw their own conclusions. However, in a larger context, there are times when it is extremely important to be explicit with the purpose of our story and to tell the listener why our story is important, like with administrators or parents. The more experience you get doing both, the better. I think the show and not tell model works particularly well with collaborative outreach efforts. It can help with building relationships. So much about outreach involves getting people to know and use the collections. And certainly the project I developed and I'm here to talk to you about today was and is driven by the vision of making connections between special collections and the communities we serve. But the key takeaway for me came to be not just about the increased use of special collections, but about increased engagement I had and continue to have with communities I work with. The visibility that afforded me was extremely important and needs to happen more. According to the OCLC report, Collections and Collections, Funding Collections and the Future of Library Collections and Collecting, published in 2014, libraries are moving from an outside-in to an inside-out model. The focus is moving away from acquiring to making what we have more visible. The report states, we can predict academic institutions will become more concerned with streamlining operational management of special collections so that the cost of continued growth in acquisitions can be moderated and more materials can be made visible. I love the concept of inside-out model because it highlights the fact that libraries are moving from passive to active roles. But what the report still doesn't do is radical engagement is about engaging in new and different ways. So much of our discussion around engagement and outreach are about getting people to interact with material. But I've argued that it's really about getting people to engage with us, the librarian, the archivist, the person. Of course, a major part of this outreach project involves getting people to use our material. And in fact, a very tangible outcome has been increased in the use of special persons by many theological seminary students, the book library's primary constituency. But with the shift from libraries being passive receivers of scholarship to becoming active participants and even catalysts in creating scholarship, we need to learn and become comfortable with engaging many audiences and dealing with an audience in single way as we do. How do we do this? I hope that the example I'm going to outline today, this outreach project, Love and Acts of Activated, I hope that it gives some concrete examples of the types of activities that can be done to go from behind our collections and standing next to us and with our community. The impetus behind the creation of Love and Action, as it was conceived of in 2014, was to increase the number of union students that used to collect special collections. Looking through the various statistics for the archival collections, and I specify archival because we also keep these separate archives in the print books. But looking at the archival collection statistics for the study, I found that out of 1,475 researchers over a 4-year span, only 3 were union students. So our case is minimal user set, a basic source of understanding of the student culture that I gleaned from conversations with student employees, my colleagues, and from reading various student publications. I embarked on creating an outreach project with the ultimate goal of getting more students into these special collections. Not only was I motivated with a real desire to get more students using the collections, I knew that doing an outreach project would have me interacting with more of the students and would also require me to learn more about the museum's history and context. The phrase Love in Action came from the 2014 Student Senate, which had adopted it as my theme for that year, and it's based off of Cornell West's words, "Never forget that justice is what love looks like in public." For the first iteration of the project, union students jumped into union archives to curate exhibits around the school's race, social, activist histories. With each of the three exhibits curated, the student curator would then organize and moderate a public panel that included both current students and alums. We were able to build upon the success of the first phase, and we received funding to bring on two student fellows to work on the next iteration, Love in Action, Voices of Social Justice. Voices and Social Justice came into being quite serendipitously. At the point, and yes, we made for the outreach, but things sometimes would happen. But at the point I was brainstorming, like, what would be the next phase of Love in Action, I got a phone call from someone who was actually a close friend, not from a union alum, who wanted to make sure that we were aware that historians and clients, both from Reconciliation to Revolution, the Student Interracial Ministry, Liberal Christianity, and the Civil Rights Movement, published. And I was certainly aware of this dissertation. I used it all the time, especially for that last iteration of being familiar with human history. But I hadn't known it was being published into a book. So, seeing that opportunity, I decided to focus on the archives of the Student Interracial Ministry, which the book has. And this is a program that was started and ran by union students in the 1960s. And I decided to have the student fellows conduct oral history interviews of alums who have participated. You know, figuring out, you know, what was being published, or maybe have a book reading, something like that. Maybe, you know, interviews alums who come to this book club or the book reading. And I just want to briefly describe what STEM was, since I'm pretty sure most people haven't heard of it before. STEM was created by a small group of union students who had attended the organizing conference at Shaw University of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, so SNCC, back in 1960. And they were inspired to do something within their own seminary-specific context. So as a regionally organized, STEM placed white students into black churches in the South and black students into white churches in the North as interns. While most people know about SNCC, most people haven't heard about the history of STEM, and neither have the union students. So it was sort of this opportunity to get people more aware of the STEM history and I work a couple different STEM levels. So two first-year students, one who is a Master of Divinity student, and the other who's a Master of Arts student, were selected as our fellows, and in addition to being able to pay the students a stipend for the entire year, I was able to work with an oral history consultant to come in and give the students a crash course on the theory and practice of oral history. Originally, I expected the students being much turn into a much more deeply collaborative effort between myself, the system fellows, several union students, alums, and several union administrative offices. Sounds like a nice little bit of fun. It's actually really wonderful. So while from the beginning, the idea of a public program that would bring some alums together with a current student was always on the horizon, it quickly became apparent that it would take center stage. The same alum, many of whom were more far in their late 70s, were not interested in a passive reunion. They wanted engagement with current students. And this was right before the election, and so you can imagine they really just wanted to see what was going on. Partnering with Union's Development and Alumni Office, we formed a planning committee that consisted of union admin, state alumni, two team fellows, and myself. The planning group grew as time went on to include union students of student affairs and several more union students. From mid-fall through the end of the spring term, the group met bi-weekly. In addition, a student alum who lives locally started to have life coffee, which would include me and sometimes one of the fellows depending on availability. Through much discussion, a one-day conference was set for May 3rd. Organizing for racial justice, 1960s and today, an intergenerational conversation. Many conversations to come upon that title, but we've already been over that. And the two student fellows, being more tapping to student body, were invaluable in this process. We were able to get feedback in a way that no one in the administration or I could ever have done. It was through their conversations with their peers that we were able developed three important outreach components to get students involved and interested in the May 3rd conference. First, many of the students became aware of no one knew what SIG was, and students really, before they were there, applied for a conference, or something like that, wanted to know a little bit more about that history. So we set up a lunch and learn, the two student fellows and myself took on a brief amount of history of time, and of course, there was free lunch. With a pop-up exhibit that featured materials from the student archive in an adjoining room. These two events served as a launch for a book club, which formed that met six times to discuss the six chapters of Klein's book. And I had originally envisioned that we'd be having materials from the archive out of each chapter of the community reading club type thing, but people generally came during lunch and brought the conference was extremely successful. That became the centerpiece. Over 75 people showed up. We did two in-depth oral history interviews, as well as setting up a story group to capture more voices and be more inclusive in that particular record. An important outcome has been the high level engagement it has afforded me to have with students, professors, and schools administration and alums. I'm just going to fast forward. Sorry, guys. I went past the word I wanted to share at the end. It's important to note that I think staff did go up. Since I started in 2014, the numbers have increased over 300 staff. You can only go up from two, but yeah, whatever. So we're going to cut that out. It's important. And so it's only getting better because people in projects like this, it can seem time consuming, but they feed each other. And this work that I do, and I feed everything, and professors actually were on some of the panels for the conference, and they're all those professors are kind of happy, and they're easy to kind of So, to wrap up quickly, the library is moving from a passive to an active space throughout the library with a diversification of every element of the research cycle, from the researchers themselves to scholarly output, comes the opportunity to make people aware of what they do and can do through collaborative efforts. So once again, taking that OCLC report, collecting directions, in a print world, the library's intersection with scholarly life cycle is limited. The library collected outputs from scholarly activity and organized them as inputs to it. In a digital environment, the intersection points multiply to include potentially support at all points in the life cycle. This then drives a deeper engagement with the research and learning behaviors of the institution and individual researchers. I would go even further and say that it's not just deeper collaboration with staff, the collections of research and learning behaviors, but with the people themselves. Not really great, but on the report, the amazing report that there's nothing about people as individuals, and professionals in that report. And I want to close with a really quick story. I've been talking with Elliot, I don't know why, and maybe you probably already heard it. But several years ago, and I think we should do things like this more, so it's really the one I'm telling you. But several years ago, I volunteered to help this day in career day. And I came in high school and really spoke to Brooklyn. The organizers grouped individuals by professions, and not knowing what to do So needless to say, everyone was confused. So while not many student actually came in the process, me and the firemen had like 3 hours of discussion. And one of them was an excellent storyteller. And in addition to putting out fires, he was also in the research. Despite that the storytelling, having leave that school after 3 hours ready to move away, the story day, like I was ready, I can't help but think of the story in relation to all of this, because one, hopefully as we get more comfortable with telling both curated and uncurated stories and get from behind the collections we steward, the more people get a better sense for what it is we do, and perhaps then we won't be taking the moment as far as an effort again. And so I know something wrong with you, so we're trying to make people. But number two, the power of story is that storytelling can drive and motivate people in unimaginable and unforeseen ways. I mean, I was really close to the whole thing, and I'm not that type of military person. But anyway, thank you so much. Collaborators, we work together a lot, and we had really great conversations over the last year. This talk has evolved a lot, and I'm really glad where we ended up today, and I'm really honored to be here today sharing these ideas with you, and their ideas. Like Robin said, what I'm about to talk about is not based in research, it's based in my own experience, and a critical reflection of that. And people we're talking about today is hard to talk about, in our institution between the special collection and the rest of the library. And that we bring the same methods and concepts that we use in outreach to engage, and that this is a flawed approach. So it's no secret that there are widespread misconceptions and misunderstandings about what it is that we do. And these narratives tend to fall into two extreme categories. Both of these are damaging. They're inaccurate and they're alienating to our communities, the communities being external, internal. And plus, these misconceptions make us really mad. Like, we love to get mad about these. That's why we're here today, because we like to get mad about it. And so we were like, let's talk about why we get mad and how, and like, let's look at how we address these misconceptions. These ideas do a disservice to our actual work. They separate us from our communities, meaning their external communities, our users, our funders, our donors, and our internal communities, our colleagues, the wider library profession. And in my experience, with these problematic narratives exist within our institutions, especially the narrative of the crown jewel in academic fresh collections, and that it's holding us back from truly meaningful, radical collaboration that pushes us all forward. Viewed as such by other departments, the question then becomes, how do special collections professionals bridge this internal gap between themselves and the rest of the library? Image was a new concept to me, that term at least, that I was always working to overcome those separations. Taking the challenge from Charlotte Crittle, which we set forth, over the last year, I set forth to address the separatedness. Should be known challenging new misconceptions about our work with social media as a result of our outreach and its image. Outreach being directed to external communities and image being educated. But what unites them is these concepts of promotion and advocacy. They often what define our outreach activities. And because we don't have the formalized image toolkit, we bring the same assumptions and the same goals of promotion and advocacy to building bridges within our institutions. And we think that the cost of it is internal and external. Charlotte Pringle offers approaches to bridging the gap within our institutions through collaborative instruction programs, dual reporting structures, round-red lunches, behind-the-scenes, show-and-tell, and I use a variety of these methods in my experiments over the last year of outreach. So we as a profession, we've done a lot of critical assessment of a lot of our practices. We've critically looked at our collecting practices and our specific practices and instruction and access, but we haven't got that same rigorous reflection to outreach and image, and I think you could be doing a great job of putting that on your talk. The concept of promotion and advocacy that underpins outreach are what I find problematic when applied to image. Promotion and advocacy are about winning the hearts and minds, getting people to agree with you, getting them on your side. There's an example of my image approach. I set up a reading group with the general reference librarians to introduce them, to teach them about the concepts, theories, and practices of special collections instruction, because I wanted to get more non-special collections librarians teaching with special collections. And I wanted them to go out and be my advocate with faculty to bring more people into special collections. We read and discussed when we looked at articles, but nothing really came out of it. There was no ongoing conversation, there was no increased teaching with special collections, there was no increased use, and no one really expressed any interest. So my argument is that my approach to image was flawed. Because it was functioning in the same way as outreach, as promotion and advocacy, and it's not a productive means to foster inclusion and collaboration with our library colleagues. We are going to have a shared goal of increased use of special collections, and I wasn't willing to stand that. That's what I was carrying with me, which I'm always a special collections librarian, and I was approaching breaking down silos, but keeping my silo intact. I wanted to still be in my special collections world. We can't approach image as a function of advocacy in education with our colleagues. And borrowing from the outreach playbook, from our approaches to inReach, we maintain the narrative of expertise and specialized knowledge that's the domain of special collections. We keep it there. We want to keep that status. And we go out into the world to help others appreciate what we have and do. We try to cultivate a passion that's similar to our own about archives and their books. And that's what's not going to happen. And by doing this, we're centering the conversation in special collections, maintaining the separation, I would argue, even though the intention is the opposite. We don't need our colleagues of what is special collections to be our advocates per se. We need them to be our partners, and we need to be their partners. In short, by centering my inReach around what makes special collections so unique, I was reinforcing the narrative of the crown jewel. Or if I wasn't reinforcing it, I was trying to live up to it. So, what are some ideas for a way out? Thinking radically. I think we need to think radically both in terms of influencing change and thinking radically in terms of the root. What is it that connects us with our colleagues? We have common goals. We all came to the profession with a lot of this similar commitment to public service, to public good, to social justice, to access. We need to focus on not what makes us different, as Beth pointed out earlier, but what connects us. And maybe it's not a skill set, but it's a passion and it's a desire to do more and do better. And we need to learn new things. We need to think about the projects. We need to learn about what other people are doing in our institutions and be. And one of these things, because we have more to offer to the field and to ourselves in free special collections than just the skills to be good special collections professionals. Charlotte Pringle does a great job of isolating the problems and maybe you all might think a little bit more about that and maybe sort of comment on some of the ways in which we might do that, or the ways in which that might really help us to pursue some of these collaborative efforts more deeply. I think that's a really good question. I think people is so important, and that is truly what can distinguish the research library. We're not going to have the same exact interests and expertise across all research libraries. We're going to have people who are particularly brilliant at something, at data archives, you know, at any number of something to do with scholarly technology, all kinds of things. And we have to be able to see those as opportunities to for collaboration. What can I bring to that table? How can I leverage that person's expertise? I just really think that there's going to be some kind of specialization that libraries are going to have, because just as resources, you know, the way resources are, we're not all going to be able to have the same kinds of programs and all be excellent at all of them. So I think one of my points is that we do know how to do outreach, and we do a lot of great outreach, but that we're not on an overall sense strategic about what it is that we do. So talking to someone about our presentation and asking, well, what's a good example of some of this strategic. So a great presentation at RBMS last year in Palm Beach was about Bill Houghton Fellowship, the Thurer Fellowship at Harvard. So very strategic outreach plan with those lovely, beautiful postcards. But what was really striking about the presentation last year was that the kind of actual planning part, that is the work. We all know how to make a postcard and, you know, pick some cool stuff from our collections to put on it. But the really strategic targeting that was done was great. And then, so that's getting into the details. An example of that is a little bit strategizing. Stepping back to what Leah said about what is the story and who is the protagonist, I think that librarianship as a whole, if anyone's going to LA, librarianship was a big sense of what the story is. It's often about democracy and the middle class and citizenship. And I think we need some of that kind of real big picture sense of story and mission that we add over our mission. One thing that helps me thinking about this and some conversations at this conference and hearing my fellow presenters today. When we think about it, is, you know, why we really need to step up and insert ourselves and call it out if we did that, take ownership. I think there's a lacking of that. It's so much about saying, look at this beautiful rare book, and I'm running away. Or sometimes, I don't know, I feel like it's not the president, the staff, the librarians, the work of the seminar, the curators, when we like to know the context. So I just feel like I just want to call that out. I don't have a direct example, but for me, example I was sharing with you. For me, I've been participating in the book club. I mean, I read a chapter and met with them and had awesome conversations about race and social justice and all these things. And I put myself out there and I just laid it out. And I think it's through those interactions that people were like, you're a person. You know? And I'm going to put it in the business. I think saying I was in a librarian for the last year. Because every time I tell people I'm a librarian, people are like, I love librarians. I mean, not as a person engineer, I'm like, what do you do? I'm an engineer. Okay? Right? So I think, you know, I love all people. for me, I'm really focused on my institution and my relationships with my colleagues and breaking down those silos. And we are stronger when we work together. You know, we're on the same team. And I think setting expertise in some ways and picking up new expertise in other ways and listening more than we're talking about, that to me is what is driving, is my driving force in terms of. We need more people, and we need to be a part of these big library that we're doing. Thank you. One of the things I always tell my staff is that all technical services are really public services because they're all in service of connecting researchers with materials.
Okay.
I didn't formulate this before.
How did you and I identify
each other? Hi, I'm Colleen Tyson, and I live here at the University of Iowa. I think a lot about the shift over to an average focus on the people. I'm having a hard time formulating this into a question. It's more of a trajectory that I'm thinking about a lot and that I hope we can continue to think about a lot. I do find the shift over to our people puts a lot more emphasis on our people, which turns into public figure territory. And there are a lot of negative outcomes to being a more visible public figure on our campus. Just in the past few weeks, we had a faculty member who wrote a piece and then received death threats in return. So I so agree with that trajectory, but also as we continue to take on those more visible roles, advocating our people and our expertise, I'm also trying to think about how we support this community as we go forward as more visible people. And I don't have a question, I'm just wrestling with this myself. So, comments, thoughts, help, let's do this. But figure out how to do it and do it well and safely.
That's great. And a really thought-provoking idea. I guess one thing that I would say is that we can work on this stuff on a really small scale or on a huge scale. And on a really small scale, we can, this is not my idea, make sure that people in special collections know how to give a real tour of the library, a whole library. Make sure they all step up when it's time to give those tours to all those students. Make sure they can do it knowledgeably. And make sure that librarians not in special collections can say something about special collections, and that's just people getting
your very low price profile. Just being so terribly wrong.
That's an outcome.
The outcome is that your staff can all get the same score and speak knowledgeably across your library. I certainly know lots of special collections where the staff don't know the library's hours, where you print something out, and whether along with your book. So even like knowing the size of the collection would be great. And then my first up many people think we're just up there and down there or over there. I know what you're talking about. So that's a really good outcome. I don't think that strategic outreach has to make individual staff more visible. I think that could be a cultural difference at different institutions. It could be different.
So
that could vary for institutions, it could vary by different people or roles within an institution. Strategic outreach doesn't actually have to be about your staff and people at all. It could be about connecting to a particular audience in a much more effective way. Colleen, I think your point is really smart, and I actually do have a colleague who is often asked to be very public and doesn't really want to be. Services, we have a very clear line between what is a reference question and what is a media request. So if you want to take me or put my face in your documentary, saying something as a talking head, that's no longer a reference question. If you're looking for an expert, put a media request, and that goes through strategic communication. If you want to find the collections or find the history or tell the story, and we can help you to do research to do that, that's a reference question. And so some staff at Special Collections and Archives may serve that excellent role and may not. And it depends on.
Hi, I'm from St. Louis, and my institution, I'm sure a lot of people have this situation, is talking to a lot of our donors. Not necessarily our day-to-day operations, but our acquisitions and our special events. That money comes from private individuals, and the thing that gets private individuals to donate is the cool materials. And while I agree with what you're saying, and while our donors are open to the idea of us doing visits and collaborations, it's undeniable that more money shows up when we pass out the fancy maps. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more to you either managing that balance or getting your donors more excited about these collaborations.
So I've been thinking a lot since yesterday morning about a session I did with donors last week, in which I and my library director and I had a digital scholarship met with a set of people, and we took materials with us, but we didn't show them the materials. We gave them to them in unmarked white envelopes, and we asked them to each take out the materials from the envelope and to engage with them and respond to a set of questions very similarly to how we might set out an instruction session. And so there were materials involved, there were materials in the room, but it was not about the materials so much as it was about the personal engagement with the materials and the stories that they could tell with the materials. So that we were not necessarily telling the story for them, we were allowing them to create their own story and ask their own questions about the materials. And it was, I don't know whether I considered it successful because I don't know what happened since then, but certainly the people in the room were very, very engaged. And they told us afterwards how much they enjoyed it. And then we sort of tied that into things that we do in the library itself. So I think that there are ways that we can work with donors that involve collections, but that also allow us to highlight some of these collaborations. Right? You can get out a cool item that you use in a class that you design with someone from the research and instruction department and talk about how the students use this thing. And I think at least at some institutions, that's really appealing. Right? People want to hear about how people are using the stuff, not just about the stuff in this. Right? can see, like, not just that they're putting their papers in a dusty basement, but that they're going to be used and they're going to live and they're going to be people are going to engage with them and their ideas and life stories. And it's not, for me, my specialty is not what's valuable to you, it's what's valuable to researchers and also how that changes.
This isn't really a question so much as just your ideas. So I have something of an idea. I have two colleagues who are one in the biomedical libraries and one in the physical sciences library. And we started a group where we get together, all of us across the libraries, and we workshop conference proposals and papers and things like that. And it's been a really fantastic way to learn about the work that they're doing and how they do that work and get outside of the special collection bubble. So just throwing that out there for anyone. They made the mistake of inviting me to one, and then I was just like, I'm going to come to all of these now. And I think they noticed that I wasn't just showing up on the day that they asked special collections to be there to give their spiel. I'm not just there to, like, secretly wait in the wings, like, waiting for me to jump in and be like, oh, well, you should use, like, special collections. And they ended up asking me to be on the subject library and steering committee. So there's a lot of collaboration that's come out of that, but I guess that's a fairly unradical idea, but it's, I think, appreciated if you just show up to events, like when they graduate assistants give presentations and they send out the library wide email, like people should come to this and just, like, showing up makes a big difference. So I had great success with that at one institution as well, and became kind of a regular person after many other people having the same experience. But also, that backfired on me at a different institution where I was seen, I think, similarly as an example as, you know, some of the special collections intruding on our department. And it was not a two-way street, I think is why. And it created a movement, to be honest. So, but also a great success somewhere else. And I would say that it's sort of I think one thing that positive and being present at those meetings, I think sometimes it's about the confusion of roles and being able to articulate why I'm there. Like sometimes I'm not there because I'm from special collections. I'm there because of a colleague who knows something or can participate. And that often when we're in a role, we're in, whether you're from special collections or like is. Sometimes everyone assumes I'm there because I'm an administrator. Those unarticulated reasons work together can be the lives of some of those kids. A couple of other things that we've done or play around with after sometimes we might, sometimes it's more comfortable being in our safe zone with special collections because there's a lot.
partners, to our nearby colleagues, to students and classrooms, and we run the sort of, particularly with our artist folks, we run that selection session with a nearby class with their participation. And this gives those, this gives the student one, it gives us an opportunity to get feedback on material that may be useful in classes and research, but also opens up to our colleagues and to students to what the possibility of a conversation. And while it's material based, it really is about people, it's not about us making selective decisions about particular things. We also play around with a concept which is called Friendship Friday. So depending if we've got a class session or something that's happening, if we've done a tour, we have recently just dropped open the front door of our special collection community. We have to open the door to come in. It's just open. Come in. Again, sort of reinforcing this concept that it's not about our boundaries. It's about just being available to anybody, for all the people. And that just sort of random open for the tour, quiet party afternoon, maybe a couple of people run around the library, switches around. Hey, what are you doing? Come over here. And we just talk. And it's a very informal boundary. Whatever is out is out. I always want to know why. It becomes less about the material and more about why. What is this stuff about? What are you guys doing? And being able to have that conversation, I think we've had some great informal partnerships that have evolved out of totally unstructured openness with what we do and with what we have. Sometimes it's chaotic, but it's also really fun. I think looking at those formal strategic layers, but also being open to just stop needing to be so formal with what we're doing and what we're trying to do. Thinking about the people and thinking about the relationship. And for me, what I'm focused on is within my institutions with my colleagues. Sometimes the collections are a way for me to hide, to say no to things. They're a crutch. And so with colleagues, I think it's okay to blur the lines about collections. But in terms of like outreach, with our researchers, yes, obviously, we still do want to promote our collections, and that is because we need to do it strategically. in terms of collaborating with other researchers, yeah, there's lots of potential there. I used to do the thing where I would get out with like the long-term researchers to write blog posts about what they're working on, if they wanted to do anything like that to promote their work, or we have scholarships that we offer. I think we can do both things. I think we can still promote the collections and not put the collections. We can be equal partners with the collections.
Take their example, so at a time when lots of places weren't collecting materials on sexuality, Cornell kind of told the story that look how far people are coming to use these collections. They're just many people coming from all over the world. That's why a lot of our institutions have those kinds of collections now. So the reputation I had is similar. We have a pretty long-standing, very rich science fiction collection. We do a lot of things that other libraries couldn't. Now, there are lots of fanzine collections, there are lots of stuff in collections, but my students at UCR don't know or understand that people come from all over the world to use our special collections because what UCR has is unique. But I think what we're saying is that it's not just about the barrier there is not that we have fanzines, it's that people come from all over the world to use them in dissertations, books, movies, documentaries. Write their own creative work, to produce their own creative artwork. So it's in the use. And again, that may just be my little source of science. But so, one of the best ones I can do. And I want to say that who went to the talk yesterday about the future of bibliographic data? That was so inspiring to me as a public service. I think that like we were hitting a moment where people were worried about the future of rare book scholarships and how we're moving into these digital environments. And I think what we have just heard from Mark is this incredible example of many people, institutions, different departments all working together to not only like keep that rare book scholarship alive, but to like take it way beyond what we can even do in a reading room. So that to me is like, that's what I want to do in my library with my colleagues. I want to do that. Part of the library. Just a little bit more details to like what actually covering what researchers might look like. So Liz again, who was still trying to get put down, but the library used to just collect the output of scholarship, used to get the book on the shelf. But we all know that's just not the case anymore, whether it's digital humanities, producing digital collections, research fellowships, doing residency librarians who want to produce projects. Like, we know that our work is not just about collecting what other people do. But the Women Action Program is part of today's student activism. And of course, you know, her archives are going to document that material as well. So it's not, there's not such a stark distinction between researcher, repository, creator, collector, and throughout all of our work, whether it's technical services, public services, whatever.
I think we have time for one more question.
And we have the library at the university. I chose to talk a little bit about one of the projects that's come out of our international scholarship program, which is this guide for our students away in from every country region on campus. To the collections. So this is, I think, taking to the gentleman just kind of got up the collection. This guide, you know, tells concentrators in chemistry some collection materials that might be interesting to them, but also poses ways that they could use them. And then I think that also speaks to what I was concerned about, you know, collections and the things that draw. So in our program, you really have this emphasis on like, what those students in the scholarship program are going to do. So they come out of it with these awkwardly inspired operas. They produce podcasts. They, you know, have these really dynamic projects, interactive computer games. And those projects themselves are fundable. That's something that you can really bring donors in to support. But beyond the products, there's this other dimension that I wanted to sort of call out, which is that the students and the teachers, they need up in the